Good evening, I'm Melissa Idris. With me, Sharad Kutta. Now, we just heard from Dr. Nungsari Ahmad Radi, economist and chairman of Khazanah Research Institute, following news that the Prime Minister today announced that EPF account holders aged below 55 can access their savings to cope with the economic impact. As Dr. Nungsari said, this is to make sure there is food on the table. But I have some statistics to share with you today. Now, the bottom fifth of all EPF members, regardless of age, have average savings of about 7,000 ringgit in both accounts. That means if we disaggregate that further, half of EPF, active EPF members, have about 7,000 ringgit in account two. The bottom 30% has 5,000 ringgit in account two, meaning that that wouldn't be enough to take to draw down 500 ringgit a month for 12 months. That's 30% of EPF members.
Right, Melissa, and that, of course, you know, exposes the realities that have been spoken about over the years of how vulnerable people are, in fact. I mean, if you only have 5,000 ringgit in your account too, how much would you have in your, you know, in account one?
Right.
And could that even have supported you at the moment of retirement? Yeah. So it's a huge, I think, shock for all of us. Again, mm-hmm. we're quite exposed to some of the vulnerabilities that have developed over the years that have not been accounted for.
Well, speaking of vulnerable groups during this restriction of movement order, now all refugee and asylum-seeking communities must be included in the government's public health response measures. This is to prevent infections from spreading among society's most vulnerable. To discuss this further, we have joining us on the line Lillian Fan, chair of the Rohingya Working Group with the Asia Pacific Refugee Rights Network. Lillian, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Now,
how much awareness would you say is there within the Rohingya refugee community in Malaysia about COVID-19, about social distancing, about even testing? I mean, have they been included in the public health response?
I think what we've seen is that actually in the last few days, there has been much more of a concerted effort on the part of the government to ensure that they are working with the right agencies and NGOs, including UNHCR, Mercy Malaysia, Imarat, and the Malaysian Relief Agency, to actually actively join hands to ensure that they're reaching out to communities on the ground. So I think, you know, when this movement restriction order first started, a lot of NGOs, together with HCR, have been working really hard to get materials out in a consistent way in terms of both prevention material in various languages. And let me emphasize, it's not just the Rohingya community. That's one refugee population here. But we actually in Malaysia have many asylum-seeking and refugee populations. And also affected by this are the migrant population, particularly the undocumented migrants. So it's really all those communities who really do need extra outreach. And I think what we've seen, thankfully, in the last few days has been much more awareness on the government's part that there has to be a particular kind of outreach towards this group. Actually, early on already, there was a circular that was put out by the Ministry of Health, even as early as the 29th of January, which basically exempted all foreigners, including, I mean, basically regardless, they didn't mention refugees, but it's basically regardless of immigration status, all foreigners who have symptoms or are a suspected case are exempted from fees for screening and testing and treatment if they are indeed positive. So that circular is still in place, and that was a really important step. And I think what we see now is that there is more awareness, but it's still extremely hard. You know, these are communities who actually often live in quite a lot of fear from the authorities. So getting them to come forward and trust the authorities and trust that they are not going to be arrested or detained or penalized in any way is really a huge effort that needs to take place.
Lillian, could you help us understand the realities of their economic lives? Because we just talked to an economist. The Prime Minister spoke today about helping Malaysians by allowing them access to EPF. There's something that's not going to be available to most refugees, or in fact, all refugees, I understand. How will they make ends meet? Most of them being in the informal sector, now shut down largely as a consequence of the restriction orders. What do you think is going to happen on that score?
Well, it is extremely hard already. I mean, I think, you know, we are seeing refugee families who are already really struggling with just basically meeting daily needs and getting daily food supplies. Refugees do really live, for the most part, in a very hand-to-mouth kind of fashion. And indeed, Sharad, as you said, they really do, if they are working at all, Many, of course, are not working, but those who are working informally in an undocumented manner in the informal sector. You know, they are, a lot of them are daily wage earners if they are working. So it is really tough on them. And, you know, we've seen already a lot of calls for help and calls for assistance in terms of particularly food baskets, just to help refugee families meet their daily needs.
Right, Lillian, I just want to touch a little bit on what you mentioned a bit earlier about the fear. There's a trust deficit between these communities and authorities, you know, the hospitals, the police, the army even. Do you think that the reassurances by the government will be believed by the refugee and undocumented worker community?
So we've actually done a lot of work to try to explain to the refugee community that, number one, that they can receive free tests and treatment if they are, you know, if they were exposed directly and if they were part of that, the Tablig, the Ishima Tablig at Sri Petaling, quite a few of them were. So that was really important to get that message out. But then, you know, many of them didn't actually believe that they wouldn't get arrested. So even just until a few days ago, we had identified communities, some of them who either had been to the Tablig gathering or who had been exposed to those who had been to the Tablig gathering. And they were really, they wanted to get testing, but they were also really terrified that they would end up getting arrested. And we actually had to do lobbying, to the government to actually say to the MKN, look, it's really important that you come up with a very clear statement that nobody is going to get arrested for lack of documentation and that the priority now is really on health and health only. And that announcement was actually finally made yesterday by the Minister of Defense, which was really welcomed. And as soon as that message came out, literally within the hour, there were Rohingya and Burmese voice messages, you know, explaining that message that were going around to the networks, you know, all the WhatsApp groups. And, you know, the communities actually started coming out. I mean, literally yesterday itself, we actually saw an increase, and today as well, of refugee and migrant communities who were much more ready to come forward.
Well, Lillian, thank you so much for speaking with us tonight and for the good work that you're doing. Thanks for sharing your insights with us. Now, we're going to take a quick break. After this, we're going to look at the ways in which the conversations around that Tablig cluster have been framed. We'll be back with more on Consider This, so stay tuned.